Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The last two decades, precipitation fell far short of typical expectations.
Weather factors behind the Western water shortage, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Following a relatively wet period in the 1990s across the Western U.S., things have really turned for the worse. Amid this period of 75% of years being drought years, we've seen dwindling reserves of water that has been exacerbated by the fact that temperatures have been above average, along with diminishing soil moisture so that runoff from snowmelt doesn't always even reach the reservoirs. Some of it soaks into part soils. Some of it is lost through evaporation due to the higher temperatures. You have the whole long-term drought situation compounded by a warming climate and the string of dry years, and that has left some of our biggest reservoirs at record low levels.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We are pretty much either committed to cotton or, as you say, unfortunately, there are a lot of people that have failed a lot of cotton out this year because of the weather situation. And so it looks like it's going to be one of those tough years. Once again, a lot of people are comparing this particular year to that epic drought period of 2011.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers, but for producers who've suffered in the past.
That original WIP program stands for Wildfire Hurricane Indemnity Program, and that did get expanded, as you mentioned, over the last few years. In fact, in 18 and 19, it was expanded to include drought and excessive heat and some of the other phenomenon that we've seen, such as that big derecho that they had up in the Midwest, that they really, most producers had never experienced anything like that up there during the all of these years. And so we have seen quite a bit of climatic activity and a lot of difficulties as far as the growing conditions. So this year, they did finally send out the information. We finally received details on the long-awaited program, which they did change the name of it. It is an extension of that WIP program, but leaf program, or ERP. And we have already seen a lot of dollars go out the door. And the good news is that even though that was long-awaited and we had to wait several months for them to be able to put details together, they were pretty successful in being able to make this much more user-friendly. And so in terms of the application, producers received a pre-filled application, and they just had to go in and approve those numbers and sign it and send it back. I've talked to a lot of producers that have gotten funding back within 5 to 6 days. And so that's been really good. Up to this point, we had a meeting at our last Friday morning. Our Plains Cotton Growers Advisory Group met last Friday, and we talked about this. And currently across the U.S., there has been about $4 billion out of the total $6 billion allocated that has already been distributed out into the countryside. And in the state of Texas, up to this point, we have come close to distributing $560 million across the area. So that will help tremendously. And so we're very appreciative of that. We knew that it was forthcoming. We just knew that they had to work out details and work out the programs. And it appears that those programs, for the most part, were successful in being locations for producers and for getting that money distributed quickly into the countryside. And you know, I have to say on their behalf, and I'm saying in terms of USDA, we were told early on, as we go back and look at that, that should come out in the first or second quarter of 22. And certainly it did. It was late in that second quarter, but we did see the funding come out. And as I mentioned, we're very appreciative of that. And we hope that that will help producers in a short year like the one that we're experiencing today.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Feeder cattle markets, it depends on whether we look at the calves or the feeders, and I say that both of them have actually shown some strength recently.
Dr. Daryl Peel is Oklahoma State University livestock economist looking at the markets.
For the calves, typically they soften during the summer from a seasonal standpoint, and we've seen them kind of actually strengthen back up a little bit counter-seasonally. The bigger feeder cattle typically are increasing through the summer to a late summer or fall peak, and they've been doing that. So we've sort of seen a little bit of strength in these markets. I think that's coming from, in some cases, it's due to some improved pasture conditions. At least they were improving. Maybe they're going backwards again now with the kind of heat we're having right now. But and then, you know, there's lots of things going on in terms of the feedlot situation and the cattle on feed situation. On the fed cattle markets, you know, again, kind of counter seasonally, fed cattle markets typically drop off a little bit during the midsummer. We're past the 4th of July now, so we'll be watching to see what happens from a beef market standpoint as well as the fed cattle market. But we've actually seen these markets strengthen a little bit, and I think that's a sign that we're seeing a very, very current situation in the feedlots. Carcass weights are very close, if not at a seasonal low, but there's lots of indications that feedlots are pretty current and that maybe we're going to see these supplies tighten a little bit as we go forward.
Speaking of moving forward, what's happening on boxed beef?
You know, boxed beef has sort of moved sideways this year. We did not see in May, ahead of the Memorial Day, we didn't see the usual kind of seasonal increase. And then the same thing in June. We did see a little pickup right in late June on boxed beef. That might have been some kind of last-minute buying for the holiday weekend. But the bottom line is boxed beef is kind of treading water, if you will. Now, that's not altogether a bad thing. Again, once we get into July here, we kind of get into those midsummer doldrums. And so this may be the real test here in the next couple of weeks or next month or so as we see whether or not boxed beef gets through the summer in somewhat better shape.
But with higher prices, there are concerns. Are we seeing demand destruction on the consumer side? In other words, are prices to the point where they're trading down?
You know, we've been watching beef demand very closely for signs of consumer resistance or pushback, if you want to call it that. Sometimes in the beef industry, we talk about trading down, where consumers either can't or choose not to buy as much of the high-priced middle meats, the steaks, and go into more value cuts and maybe more emphasis on ground beef. We've had an extremely strong ground beef market really for a year, and I think that's just fundamental demand for that. And, you know, we haven't seen, I think, a lot of serious sort of pushback or moderation, if you will, of beef demand. And part of the reason is that we're actually getting some support from the other proteins. Mm. Chicken prices, broiler prices have actually gone up continuously the last several months, while beef has held a little more steady at the retail level. And so it's actually made beef, in some sense, even though it's at a fairly high level, it's made beef a little bit cheaper. So, and of course, our last hog and pig report showed that the hog industry is in contraction. Pork prices have also stayed steady to a little bit higher. So across the board, proteins are relatively expensive, but within that protein complex, you know, beef is holding its own very well at this point.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know, categorical exclusion is another part of that NEPA process, which gives flexibility to the agencies.
Patrick O'Toole's a Wyoming rancher testifying recently before the Senate Natural Resources Committee on drought.
The river that I live on crosses the state line 32 times. That means that our valley is both Colorado and Wyoming. So I'm in two forests, two BLMs, two game and fish, two fish and wildlife, and have a lot of experience with the agencies. It is human-driven. And there was a fear of failure or fear now, as I expressed earlier, that, you know, the agency people need to have a mission. And we're going to have to send a message. We've sent money. There's money in the infrastructure bill to achieve. But that isn't going to be achieved if we don't have a mission to use the tools. And I think that, you know, my personal experience is, I have the best conservation district in the U.S. I really am so lucky. just give you an example, 17% of farmers use it, and ours it's 90, because we have trust built. Mm. We use categorical exclusion. The surrounding conservation districts are coming to us asking for, how do you get that done? Because you don't have the agency people who have experience with it, and because of the litigation issue that you mentioned, that I've mentioned, it's really inhibiting our ability to do what we've all agreed we need to do.
And what about this idea of more but smaller watersheds?
The Endangered Species Act looms over all of us. And having the flexibility of water for migratory birds, for example. You know, our family's working on Upper Colorado endangered fish and sage-grouse. And having storage to release later, it, once you've seen, you know, I hope this doesn't sound too bold, but 3 years ago I could have told you what was going to happen to me in Lake Powell, because you weren't seeing the springs. The springs in my world are drying up, so I'm putting in solar wells and solar panels and doing every innovative thing I can do. You can have all the grass in the world. If you don't have water, you can't run livestock. So, you know, it has such multiple benefits, and part of those is protection. And, you know, when I'm with my grandkids riding around and we see migratory birds, we're as excited as we are about the genetics of our livestock, because we realize we're in a system. And this idea of watersheds with small storage at the tops of the watersheds, the one we're looking at is at 8,200 feet. That takes away the issue that Mr. Insmeer talked about with losing, you know, water from heat and those issues. So high mountain storage and watershed storage are the future.
Dr. Maurice Hall is with the Environmental Defense Fund, says you have to keep evaporation and transpiration in mind.
When we talk about evaporation and transpiration from plants, it is a really important question in our overall water balance. And in fact, living in northern New Mexico, seeing the fires, I realize very keenly how much management of our forest makes a difference. And there's lots of work going on now to better understand how forest management can reduce the transpiration from the forests and the watersheds and provide other benefits, improved habitat, improved recreational experiences, et cetera. And so to the point of Mr. O'Toole's spring flow diminishment, that's something that we're seeing across the West, and undoubtedly higher evaporation rates, which are going to happen when you have higher temperatures, are part of that issue. And so to the point of investing in our natural infrastructure, looking at forest management very carefully and implementing the right management for our forests and frankly to rangelands as well, to improve the water yield and provide other benefits, is a really important thing for us to invest in and get figured out and get moving on.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Again, on the grain stocks report, really everything in the June 1 in those June 1 stock numbers are kind of in line with trade expectations.
Dr. Joe Jansen is an ag economist with the University of Illinois.
It does imply a pretty strong usage through the last quarter of the marketing year for corn and soybeans, but we think that that situation is justified, and so our forecast for feed and residual use for corn and really all other parts of the old crop balance sheet are largely unchanged. Maybe some decline in corn demand in the last quarter of the marketing year, but that's not really the big picture. The big surprise here was on the acreage side, 2.6 million fewer soybean acres than USDA projected in its March prospective plantings report. A little bit higher corn acres, which we thought was possible. We saw, you know, high corn prices through the planting period, and it really seems like U.S. farmers, to the extent that they could, really tried to make sure that corn acres got in the ground. And so we do see a slight increase in corn acreage in spite of declining corn acreage in the upper Midwest. That was sort of where the bulk of the big changes in these numbers were concentrated. Lower corn and soybean acres in North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota, likely caused by prevented plants and the excess moisture and late planting conditions that occurred in that part of the world. For the overall supply and demand picture, we see a continuation of tight grain and oilseed supply and demand balances. New crop supply and demand balance for soybeans remaining incredibly tight. Maybe some some relaxation of that tightness on the corn side, given sort of potential demand headwinds related to exports and ethanol. That said, we remain in a much higher than average historical price period. We still see new crops corn futures at 625, new crop soybean futures in and around 1460. Those are very high price levels, but ones that imply very high price volatility, especially related to the weather news that we have in corn. I mean, we've seen this kind of situation move, on a knife edge, really through the last few weeks, and we don't anticipate that that situation changes. The market's going to be incredibly sensitive to weather news going forward.
Also at the University of Illinois, ag economist Dr. Scott Irwin.
Hey, Joe, I was just smiling to myself because our age difference is showing, because one of my formative experiences was living through the high inflation years of the 1970s and early 1980s. And what's, other people that are my age that I talk to says this feels remarkably a lot like that. And in fact, you see, I saw a well-known economist yesterday just, we hear words like stagflation, which we haven't heard for, almost three decades. So very important to see how this macroeconomic situation evolves. Well, I guess I'll go back to the one thing that I never have forgotten from that experience is on the chart that we put together here, it implies, massively negative real interest rates. So that's the nominal minus the inflation rate. And that's not something one way or the other that's going to persist.
Joe Jansen, Scott Irwin, both at the University of Illinois. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There are some areas that are within our 42-county service area that look pretty decent.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers on how the drought's affecting the crop.
In fact, we have some cotton that is in bloom. Now, it's certainly in the minority, but we do have some blooming cotton here, and we like to talk all the time about July 4th blooms, but really, that's pretty much of a rarity. It's typically more along the middle of July before we really start seeing very many blooms year in and year out. But I can tell you that in parts of Crosby and Floyd counties, parts of Hale County, over in that area, there's some good-looking cotton. There's some good-looking cotton on the east side of Lubbock County. As we get down south of Tahoka and move into Dawson County and on down into Martin and Midland counties, they are really facing a dry time down there. In fact, my understanding is that down in Midland, they have recorded the driest period ever for September of 2021 to May of 2022. And so they have already surpassed their driest period. And certainly the cropping situation shows. We keep talking back to 2011. We probably are not to that point in terms of overall drought across the state of Texas. However, there are some areas up here in the Panhandle that certainly are experiencing a dry time. Another thing is, as you mentioned, a lot of guys say that they don't have the irrigation capabilities. Tony, one big factor is that in 2011, we began the year with a pretty fair amount of subsoil moisture. And as this year in 2022, we did not experience any late fall or any winter rainfall. So everybody started out completely dry. And I still talk to producers every day that talk about what kind of irrigation capabilities that they lost by pumping those wells so hard in 2011. A lot of producers are saying they won't make that mistake again, and a lot of them are saying they can't do it again, that they just don't have the well capacity to be able to do that.
Which brings the question, what will it take to survive with less water? Dr. Maurice Hall with the Environmental Defense Fund.
The quicker that we can get on the same page, understand the challenge that we're facing, what our current situation is and our trajectory is, the more quickly we can get to solving problems. A handful of ideas of things that I think are important in our work, where we need better science and data, is in the area of proactive groundwater management. We have this incredible natural infrastructure below our ground that frankly provides the drinking water and water supply for most of the rural West. And we can better understand that if we invest in the right data and begin to use that and manage it more proactively. I think another issue is short-term forecasting. We have so much better information now about what's actually going to happen, not just today, but over the next several days in our rain and snow systems. And knowing that data sooner allows us to make better decisions on reservoir operations and improve the yield of the projects that we already have in place.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today,
a symbol of a steadily increasing water shortage out west.
Lake Mead, which is behind Hoover Dam, we have seen water levels steadily dropping in recent years to the lowest level that we've seen since the dam was initially constructed in the 1930s.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says factors include a distinct drought pattern since the U.S. Drought Monitor was established in 1979.
In the last two decades plus, we have seen about 3 out of 4 years on average from California to the Southern Rockies as drought years. And with that string of drier than normal years, that has put a severe strain on Western water supplies.
Additional factors such as above average temperatures and diminishing soil moisture that has curbed mountain snowpack runoff combined with the drought years has left some of the West's largest reservoirs at record low levels, with Rippey noting no relief is in sight to improve Western water supply levels. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
So could desalinization be the answer? Senator Angus King from Maine is a member of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee with Dr. Maurice Hall with the Environmental Defense Fund.
As a water resource engineer, I'll tell you that we like to build things, and we have studied lots of possibilities, and some that some we've implemented, some were good ideas, some turned out not to be so good ideas. And some are just not cost effective. And so with respect to pipelines and desalination, that cost issue is certainly a big one. Some of the most expensive water in the West, on the order of $2,000 an acre foot, comes from the desal plant that was recently completed, in the last 5 years or so, at Carlsbad in San Diego. For San Diego, who is at the end of the Colorado River water distribution system.
But also adjacent to the ocean.
And ocean adjacent to the ocean, with, in fact, an already existing outfall to help dispose of the brine at a lower cost. It made sense as part of a resilience portfolio for the city. And in some other targeted areas, desal does make sense.
But to reach the kind of scale to relieve this whole region is not really feasible. Is that your suggestion?
At this time, it is not feasible. Due to cost and other environmental issues.
And interestingly, looking at this chart, the drought sections are surrounded on both sides by more water, excessive precipitation, which suggests, as Senator Barrasso talked about, storage, but a lot of storage. I mean, it a couple of years won't really solve it if you're talking about a 20 to 40 year cycle. So storage is part of the problem, part of the solution also, isn't it?
Certainly, storage can be really valuable, and especially in our current situation, can be a helpful tool in making our deployment of the water more flexible. In most of the West, frankly, there isn't enough water to fill the storage.
Today. But I'm talking about in the 80s, there was an excessive rainfall in the West, which if we could have captured that and held it for 20 years, it might have helped. Let me ask one other, not a question, but just an observation. Fascinating experiment going on in California now of building solar panels over canals, which will generate electricity but also diminish evaporation. If you could build a solar farm on top of Lake Powell, you could supply electricity for all of the West and diminish the enormous water loss to evaporation. I'm not ready to undertake that project, but we've really got to think in new and different ways
Absolutely.
Here, because this is, as many people say, unprecedented. At least it's unprecedented in the last 500 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
How would one define a successful dairy farmer? University of Minnesota's Jim Sulfur acknowledges.
It probably changes, and it probably is really variable from farm to farm. A lot of that really should be based on the farmer's goals.
Whether it's family, financial, or business-oriented. Yet regardless of goals, Sulfur notes some common characteristics among successful dairy growers.
You can almost kind of lump them into two broad categories, kind of big picture items, business items, and then there's obviously you need to have a lot of good, successful production skills.
And he says it starts with producers having what he calls an attitude of gratitude.
They're so gracious. If I come out, they'll be thankful. They'll thank the agribusiness people that are out there as we meet, and they just go out of their way. And they're also very thankful for the customers that they have.
Passion for work, planning an organization, and skilled at caring for their cows are other traits of successful dairy farmers recognized by Sulfur. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.